Long-term unemployment benefits are about to start flowing again, and Iowa's unemployment rate seems to be stalled at 6.8%. It's Politics Day on the Talk of Iowa. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll talk about the unemployment picture and the long-term outlook for jobs recovery. The battle over immigration policy is heating up. We'll talk about the political implications of that and the decision to send 1,200 National Guard troops to our southern border. You may be surprised by what they'll be doing there. Also, we'll talk about where the money is coming from in the race for governor. Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst, will be here today, along with Bruce Gronbeck, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Iowa. We'll also be taking your calls, 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org after this news. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we are talking politics today. The odds are very good that by the end of today, jobless benefits will have been restored to the 2.5 million Americans who have lost their unemployment since June 2nd. Iowa's unemployment rate seems to be stalled out at about 6.8%. And we'll talk about the unemployment picture and the long-term outlook for jobs recovery. We'll also take a look at immigration policy, a controversial firing at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and where the money is coming from in Iowa's race for governor. And, of course, we will be taking your calls. The number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me today are Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. Hello, Arnie.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for being with us today. And also Bruce Gronbeck, professor emeritus of communication studies at the University of Iowa. Thank you so much for coming in today, Bruce.
A pleasure, Charity.
Well, I want to talk about unemployment first. Now, the legislation has passed the Senate. It's on its way to the House. It could actually be signed by the president by the end of today. Arnie, how quickly could benefits actually start flowing again?
Well, I think what's going to happen is that depending on where you are, it may take a couple of weeks, but it's going to be a significantly large check because I think it's going to be post-dated to the time your benefits ran out. So for some people, they're going to see some significant dollars coming in, and obviously those are dollars that, you know, pay the electric bill, pay the mortgage, pay the food bill, and they're not dollars that sort of create a comfortable life. One of the things I did, Charity, in anticipation of our conversation on unemployment compensation, was I was listening to Senator Stabenow from Michigan talking this morning on the radio, and she was saying that the average weekly benefit in the United States is $308. So I thought I would give everyone sort of a snapshot of where they landed depending on what state they lived in. Iowa, you're actually above the national average at $340 a week, which means you rank 16th. I'm right now doing radio in the state of Massachusetts in the next hour, and they come in at a whopping $460 a week, one of the highest. But my home state of New Hampshire, I just want everyone to know, cheap is a total of $270 a week is the amount of that unemployment check on average. So I just want people to understand the range and then to go and look at their bills and see what they could cover with that amount of money. So if you've been looking for work for a long period of time, even with that unemployment check, you have been tapping into every kind of resource possible and you've been changing your lifestyle significantly.
Well, the unemployment rate in Iowa does seem to be stalled out at this 6.8%. And I have to say, Bruce, you and I were just talking about Michigan because you lived there for quite some time. And, of course, I just moved back from Michigan about a month ago. Coming from Michigan, 6.8% seems really good because, you know, Michigan's been right at that 15%.
It's been at that 15% line. That's right. And stalled out there. And plus, given the size differences, that's a phenomenal economic impact.
Right, but how significant is 6.8% for Iowa?
Well, Iowa it's difficult, you know, given the kind of economy you have. Because what that tends to reflect again is of course on the urban and the salaried portion of the population, less so than on the farm related or agricultural side of the population. So it gets magnified in essence for some of the people that the state has been trying for the last two decades to attract, to begin to build new upscale businesses in the cities, try to hold its students to keep them from running out of the state, seeking all the glory they can in Chicago. They love Chicago. They love
it's true. Half of my graduating class from high school is in Chicago.
That's right. They love Chicago. And so it really has made it hard to keep any kind of a growth curve going. It's not as though the absolute number, in other words, is the difficulty. It's where it tends to hit. Now, I'm not saying, you know, it's a bed of roses out there sitting on a tractor. That's not the point. It's not. I did enough of that as a teenager to know I was really quite happy when I was able to get away from that life, even though I still live in the countryside. But it's how that hits you that really makes the difference, so that Iowa is feeling the pinch.
Right. And I think the other thing is, too, Charity, is that we're seeing a lot of seniors making decisions based on this very fragile economy, these incredibly low interest rates, a market that isn't really doing much of a return for them in particular, deciding not to leave a job, you know, or to scramble to get any kind of job. And that's also changing the way people view the economy and the unemployment numbers, because it's now not just about the guy who's in his 30s and 40s. It's not about the kid that's just coming out of college. It's about people who are 65 and 67 and 71 suddenly realizing they have to remain in the workforce in order to manage the rest of their lives. And that's a very different conversation than the kind of conversation we had maybe even just 10 years ago.
Now, Iowa kind of lagged behind the rest of the nation in getting into the recession. Do you think that means that we haven't quite bottomed out yet? Are we lagging in the recovery as well?
I don't think so. It means, of course, in an absolute sense, it means that we have less to go in the recovery. But Iowa traditionally is slow in moving into a depression, and frankly, slow coming out. Because this is not a place where a lot of big investment firms make their moves to make as part of a recovery operation, because again, our labor force isn't particularly big, especially our urban kind of labor force. So Iowa tends to be slow coming out of recessions as well, and I would expect that to happen again. But again, most of these things simply don't bite this place as hard as they do other places. Easy for me to say, since I am retired and living on that retirement income. I think that's a good sign for Iowa. It tends to slide back a little more slowly, but well.
I did see a report that came out of the Center for Economic and Policy Research that says it could take an entire decade for the national unemployment rate to come down to pre-recession levels. Arnie, do you think we have a clear picture of how serious the situation is?
No. I mean, we are so globally connected that it's we can't even just look at our state. We can't even just look at our country. We have to just, you know, step back with a much bigger lens and look at the interaction in the global economy as well. I mean, all those things play a significant difference. But there was a really interesting piece, I think it was in the Washington Post, where they looked at the impact of, you know, funding unemployment and what it does in the way of a stimulus. You know, and how does it really, does the money come directly into the economy? And it turned out that things like food stamps and work share and extension of unemployment benefits, those things show a greater sort of dynamic impact on the rest of the economy than doing what we have traditionally said, which is tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. And in the end, it turns out that these things, especially given the nature of how vulnerable we all are, make a significant difference. And in the end, what people want is they want to see a result, not just a result for a family or for an unemployed worker. They want to see a result for the economy. And it turns out this does have a direct economic impact.
Well, Jeff is on the line with us from Des Moines. He called 866-780-9100. Hello, Jeff.
No, I've known people out of work who have had to get unemployment, so I just want to say I think it's very good news that it got passed. I was a little bit surprised that the Republican Party would say that they're going to draw this big line in the sand to keep money away from poor and suffering workers. And at the same time, they're also drawing a line in the sand saying they want to keep more tax cuts for, you know, the Paris Hiltons and the Bill Gates, and And I just, you know, I guess I'm just a little confused. It seems like we got into this recession with a $1.5 trillion couple of wars and then a $1.5 trillion tax cut for the richest 1%. And now the Republican Party is fighting all out to keep another, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of Paris Hilton and others' money out of the Treasury. And also, we just found out that several of the Fortune 500 corporations paid zero taxes on April 15th. So I guess I'm just, it's just perplexing to me why, you know, what is happening here. And if that party gets into power again in November, if we're just going to sort of, you know, revert back to this kind of thing where the only thing you seem to be for is tax cuts for millionaires.
Bruce, you want to respond to that?
Yeah. I should have been listening to On Point yesterday. They went on for an hour yesterday morning on NPR on this topic. And the argument, just to give you the argument goes like this, that the economic impact of unemployment benefits, let's say, is more or less one-to-one. The government spends a buck, and then the person who gets the benefit spends that buck into the economy. And so in that sense, it's a pretty straightforward economic transaction. Whereas all those people, all that money that they talked about, they're buying those $5,000 wristwatches. If they take that money and invest it, then it will create jobs that will in turn give people a wage and on which they'll pay taxes. So the impact of that dollar spent in giving it to the rich to build the businesses is much greater than giving it to the unemployed person. Now, as I say, that's the argument. And I think that you're going to hear that argument, I think, all the way, not simply through this election, but it's certainly going to roll to the next election and the election after that as well. It's the ongoing liberal-conservative argument.
But Bruce, it doesn't make sense, because what we know is that the rich are back, that they're almost at the exact level they were at their highest point ever in 2007. And where are the jobs? Where is the economy? Where is the stimulus? Where are all those unemployed people getting all that money, because all the rich have their money back? I mean, that's where I go kooky as I listen to this, because I'm saying you're sitting on a pile of cash. Where's the investment? What happened? So, again, that's where you have to raise a big question mark as to what this means. And I just want to add one more piece to your caller, which is they talk about wanting to maintain the tax cuts. They don't want to extend unemployment benefits, but that's not true. They want to extend unemployment benefits if we can pay for them. So the way to pay for them is by actually not having the tax cuts on the very rich and, you know, basically repeal them, and then you could pay for those unemployment benefits. So there is actually a way to pay for it, but they want everything that doesn't make sense. They don't want any money to come into the coffers to pay for the unemployment benefits, but then say we won't pay for them unless we have the money. So I'm a little confused. And more importantly, I just want to remind you who died in the last couple of days, but this very wealthy guy named Steinbrenner. And, you know, some of you may be weeping, but I'm weeping because he could have contributed $450 million in an inheritance tax that doesn't exist today. Not a dime, everyone. Not the one, the penny goes into the federal coffers.
All right. We will continue this conversation in a moment. You're listening to The Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. It's The Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking politics today. And with me are Bruce Gronbeck, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, and, of course, Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. We're also taking your calls. The number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, I want to move on from unemployment in a couple of minutes, but we do have a couple of callers who certainly want to weigh in on this subject. We have Dwayne on the line in Marshalltown. Hello, Dwayne.
Hello.
What would you like to talk about?
When John Maynard Keynes wrote his articles or his papers, it was back in a time when we had a rural economy, and the money that went from to the rich people were going to local bankers and car dealers and such. We have a corporate system now in a segregated society in which the money that's going out of that top group have no direct influence on business whatsoever. They own the stock market. And so what happened is back when Bush and Reagan had the cuts, took the money out of the industrial system and put it into the stock market. This is why we had this tremendous growth in the stock market, because the money didn't go to any particular business. And the only way we get stimulus is through the lower end of the poor people, basically. And your multiplying factor is way lower there. And that's why the Republicans are relying on this fallacy of the 1930s. But what's happening now, that's why our economy did collapse. When Reagan started this thing, all the money went into the stock market and out of the industrial society, and the stock market invested in China, which was a good investment for them. Meanwhile, the differential tax that they had was essentially increasing the tax on the lower end, on the Reagan to Bush tax cuts. And by increasing the tax on the lower class relative to the society, they paid a larger percent. And when this larger percent was paid, that took money out of what they normally said was the factories and industrial society.
I agree. Keynes would be proud of you. I think one of the most serious problems that this country and most countries in the world face is that an awful lot of money is made not on producing widgets, but on moving money. You make money on money, not on toys, not on trucks, not on cars, not on corn. And it's moving away. All, and you're right. I think our fundamental economic theories were built on supply and demand of goods and services, and somehow investment doesn't really fall into either the goods or services categories as they were originally designed.
Well, and I think his idea is, you know, that you've heard that classic line over again: did it trickle down or did it trickle out? And that's really how people are beginning to sense it. Again, I go back to, we are in a global economy.
Yep.
And people are going to make investment where they can get the biggest bang for their buck, where they can, you know, spend the most and get the most back in the sense of return. And it may turn out that this is not the best place for a return, although it is the best place because it is where you live, because it is the consumer you want to help support, because there's a patriotic reason for it, there's a community sense reason for it, there's a sense of independent reason for it. But when you're only looking at the bottom line and it's all about money, then maybe it isn't the wisest investment, although it might be the right investment.
Well, I want to move on from this subject. I have a feeling we'll get pulled back into it in a little while. But this week, in fact, yesterday, the numbers came out for both Chet Colver and Terry Branstad, their fundraising numbers. They made their financial disclosures. And Bruce, why don't you weigh in on this? It looks like Terry Branstad has a lot of fundraising momentum going on.
He does. He raised in the last quarter a little over $2 million. So that he ended up raising, I should have done the math before I got into this position. He raised about three quarters of the amount of money that Colver has in his bank account right now. That's a significant effort. And again, in part, you expect some fundraising differences because of an incumbent versus a very odd kind of challenger, a previous incumbent, and you certainly have this differences because of the very strong effort of the GOP in fundraising, given how much ground they're trying to recover in this state, in both the houses of the legislature and in the governorship, and trying to hang on to the Senate seat and so on.
The numbers are kind of funny, though, Bruce, because you got to also remember that you've got the Democratic Governors Association and the Republican Governors Association sending huge checks.
Right. That's where
so
most of Culver's money's
coming from.
Branstad
getting, what,
right,
about $1 million in that last cycle, and you've got, you know, Chet Colver getting $250,000
in the last cycle.
But when you look at all the money that's come into Colver, it's about $1.5 million from the Democratic Governors Association.
Plus,
so
they paid for some advertising.
Like big check,
too.
Right.
But you know, you got to look beyond what the total is.
No, that's true. Once again, back to the question of the source, right?
Yeah.
And
where does
it come from?
Right.
Well, what do you think this says about the race? That I mean, Colver, obviously, the Democratic Governors Association considers him to be endangered, and they are doing everything they can right now to keep him in office. But what do you think the disparity here means for the race in November?
I think that's hard to say right now. That I can, again, because of this odd situation of having an incumbent and a previous incumbent at it, and I think they both have strengths and they both have some vulnerabilities. The most interesting aspect of the race for me right now is that both of them have gone strongly negative already. They've gone strongly negative in July. The Culver ads are particularly vicious right now. The Cook the Books, for those of you that have been watching these ads, the Cook the Book ads, all these blatant assertions sitting out there without an explanation of what it means, because, of course, you want your opponent to offer the explanation so that they look defensive. Just as the Branstad side is showing ads with black backgrounds and stark economic numbers, creating a depressing picture of the Iowa economy and putting it in the lap of the governor. The fact that we're already to this stage, one, of course, is simply an indication of the economic mood around here, which is governing the political mood, and that's certainly true in most parts of the country. But also the fact that neither the gubernatorial campaign seems to have much in the way of strong policy pieces that they think could actually make a lot of difference. And if we're already going negative this time of the year, it's going to be a long, depressing fall.
I have two points. I just want everyone to know that Van der Plaats has only $1,500 in his bank account. So if you're wondering what he's doing, I'm not sure how much. I want to throw that one in. And as I'm listening to your description of the ads, I keep going back to an old Governing magazine editorial where he described all campaigns in America could be dumbed down to two simple sentences: me, citizen; him, crook. So, everything is sort of so black and white, and the fact that they're going negative and no one has a positive message or an inventive policy idea tells you that we all recognize we're in this mess together, and there is no magic bullet.
Right.
There is none.
The maxim I go to is the old Terrence Group maxim from the 80s. A voter ultimately votes one of two ways. You either vote for somebody or against somebody. Either way, you've made a decision. And that, of course, became the springboard to the negative ads. And while we don't know still an awful lot about their effectiveness, we know a couple things. We know, one, that people say they hate them, but they remember them. And that's an awfully important aspect of them. Two, we also know that they tend in heavy campaigns to depress the electorate, to actually make it shrink. As people say, I'm not going to vote for the evil of two lessers, and so I'm going to bail out and not take part in this election. If we're already, hammering away with those kinds of ads now, I look forward, as I said, to a very dismal fall.
Well, in a moment, I want to move the conversation on to another former governor, because very early this morning, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack sent out an email saying that he would reconsider the firing of Shirley Sherrod. Is it Sherrod or Sherrod?
Sherrod,
thanks. Mm-hmm. A Georgia-based Agriculture Department official. So we're going to get into that conversation in about 5 minutes. Before the break, now one last firing on the discussion we were having earlier. Nancy sent us an email saying that, having been a registered Republican for 25 plus years, I finally realized that the Republican Party didn't have my best interests and welfare at heart. I'm now a registered independent. What I find frustrating is all of the Republican talk about the deficit and not caring about children and the unemployed. So that's a final comment on that subject. I hope you'll join us as we move on. 866-780-9100 or at IPR Talk. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking politics today on the Talk of Iowa. And with me are Arnie Arneson, a New Hampshire-based political analyst, and Bruce Gronbeck, professor emeritus of communication studies at the University of Iowa. And we'd also love to hear from you. The number is 866-780-9100. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And you can also tweet us at IPR Talk. And I want to move on now to talking about this controversial firing at the Department of Agriculture. Tom Vilsack this morning at 2 o'clock in the morning sent out an email saying that he would reconsider the abrupt firing of Shirley Sherrod. And what happened in this situation is that there was a speech that she gave at the NAACP not too long. Well, I guess quite a while ago, but in March. All right. And somebody apparently doctored the tape and played just a bit of it that made it sound like she was racist. And she got fired for that.
It's what's so frightening is that I think it was posted on biggovernment.com. So here's the sad thing. Everyone had a little bit of time to access the full context of her tape. And the problem is we know that there are assassins out there. That's what they are. They're political assassins. They take your words. They doctor your words. They edit out the conclusion because they only want you to hear the opening statement. And for people to be judged on a website that has a history of doing this by people from the Obama administration, from former Governor Vilsack, to whomever, to fire someone, even the NAACP jumped to the gun. That's what's so frightening. We live in incredibly hot times where if you respond to the moment, you are probably responding incorrectly. And I just wanted to share something with you. A friend of mine from Washington sent me this morning. He said, the motto of those who sought Ms. Sherrod's resignation, at least those in the administration, seems to be surrender first, ask questions later. It's part of the pundit's delusion that Paul Krugman wrote about recently. The notion that politics is about winning the ever-shortening news cycle and that perception counts more than reality. It's bad politics and very bad policy.
And now the NAACP has put up on their website the complete version of this speech so people can watch it, listen to it, and make their own conclusions. Tom Vilsack is revisiting, you know, now they're asking the questions, revisiting that decision. And for her sake, Shirley Sherrod says she's not entirely certain she wants to go back if they do offer her a job back. Danielle in Woodward wants to weigh in on this subject. Hello, Danielle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for your patience.
Sure. I'm a member of the Women Food and Agriculture Network. I'm a founder member and also a former board member. I have nothing but good things to say about Shirley Sherrod, and I am glad that our former governor is reconsidering this decision. The NAACP has reversed itself, and I agree with Arnie's analysis about the situation. And correct me if I'm wrong, but odd ally. I think Glenn Beck was critical of the administration for doing what it did. And my question to Arnie is, how can the Democrats get back on message? I'm very worried that with the great callers you've had this morning, great economic analysis, explained very well, why can't the Democrats fire back and do a slap down with these outrageous comments from the radical right?
Because there's a different kind of echo chamber. And please don't be insulted by this public radio. I love you. I do you. I'm doing public radio in Boston today on WGBH. But there's a difference between the kind of radio that is presented on public radio, which is balanced and has, you know, people from all different perspectives, and we discuss something. And then you have rant radio, where, you know, misinformation or doctored information or partial information is fed for 3 to 7 to 10 hours a day over and over again, and urban legends become our reality. And so even if people, and they did that study, I think you heard about it, Charity, where there was a study done that said even when you show people the facts,
right,
because they are so wedded to their mythology, they don't embrace the truth. They actually almost harden onto the fairy tale that they've decided is what's real and defines their lives. That's the part that is so scary. And what just happened with this woman from Georgia is an example of how instead of giving people time to breathe, we are equally responding in this hot, uninformed way. This is a disgrace what happened to her, but it just proves that that kind of misinformation is really winning the day.
Danielle, thank you for your call. Bruce, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean... What's happened? I think Arnie makes a good point, and I just expand that. What's happened with the 24/7 news cycle is that there is a phenomenal amount of information or presumed information flying around. And then when you add in the bloggers, and certainly an important player in this story was the Breitbart blog, one of the major bloggers on the conservative side, an angry voice, and with enough of a following so that people pay some attention, if only in a self-protective way. I mean, what just stuns me about this story is that somehow the stuff that he repeated and played then gets recirculated and becomes the basis for a decision without a further follow-up. The man's reputation is so suspect that I can't believe that happened. Even he's had to defend himself and say, hey, that's what I got. I got this version. I didn't do that. The whole thing is so odd. And I think for the NAACP, this also hits right at the time that boss man Ben Jealous has been in the business of going after the Tea Party and telling it to purge itself of its racists. So you got the whole racism stuff in the air. It's there again today in the New York Times in Ross Douthat's column on white anxiety and especially among poor whites in view of all the preferential treatment of people of color. We are sitting in a situation now, in other words, where information circulates at amazing speed. You don't always take time to check it out to see what happens because you are, Arnie's right, you are going to make sure you get it on the next hour's news if you've got it.
Yep.
And you run with it hard. And we are, as I am fond of saying, awash in information and unfortunately sitting with very little knowledge that helps us sort through it.
But the idea that, I mean, remember, innocent until proven guilty, innocent until proven guilty. When you look at the source, how could you not have raised the question from the get-go?
I agree.
That's the part that – this is where I am so afraid because everything is so inflamed. It is inflamed. It is not process. It is not stepping back. We have talked about the fact with the Tea Party that there are some members of the Tea Party that are racist. There are also people who are incensed because they are so not racist. The problem is it's an organization that has no leadership. So who do you turn to say off with their heads? Who do you turn to say what is thematic about the Tea Party? Because what is thematic is nothing. Is nothing except there is a cohesion of anger and frustration, you know, and that takes many different faces. But in light of that, for an administration, and I am very angry at former Governor Vilsack, because what he should have done is said, I will take this, we will investigate, I will get back to you. But there was no time for that because the news cycle demanded a reaction, and the reaction was throw her under the bus.
And it'd be called a bureaucratic cover-up when he did it.
Yeah.
It'll feed right back into the cycle. It's a difficult position.
Well, and I've heard reporters complain about this as well, because journalists who work for cable news networks have complained about the fact that they're on television so much, they have to stand up and talk so much that they can't actually do any reporting. You know, so they have this constant need to feed the monster, but they don't have the time to get out there and make the phone calls and do the research that they need to do.
But we live in a time where you don't even need to have a camera. You don't even need to have equipment. You can do anything in front of your computer. You can Photoshop stuff. You can video and edit things. I mean, people should understand more than ever that what you see may not be even close to what is reality, because you don't need to be technically savvy. You just need to have a damn computer at your desk. You know, and that's what makes information so frightening right now, because it comes down to one word, trust. What can you trust?
All right. Well, I want to move on to another very hot button issue, which is immigration. And the White House has made this decision to sue Arizona over the new immigration law. And that has really fanned the flames of the immigration debate. So I want to talk about the long term implications of that. But also this news that the Army is going to be deploying 1,200 National Guard troops to the southern border. Arnie, you had some interesting information on that.
Well, what was interesting was that they were sending them down to assist in processing information and doing things like that. But one of the most important lines, I wish I had it right in front of me, was the line where they said they were there to process the guns and money that was flowing illegally into Mexico. Excuse me? Did everyone hear what I just said? Not what's coming from Mexico here, but about the guns and money that were illegally flowing into Mexico. So I think for the first time it recognizes that there is a problem, but the problem exists on both sides of the border, and that some of our bad behavior has now negatively influenced what's happening in Mexico as well. So when you're looking at the cartels and you're looking at all the violence and you look at where the guns and the money is coming from, a lot of it is coming from us. And I thought that was a very interesting comment as we just look at the fact that, you know, troops are going down there. The question again is, what are they doing? You know, the headline tells you nothing. It tells you location, 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 but it doesn't give you content.
Well, it does seem like a good sign, though, that's what they're doing, because it seems like we're approaching a little more nuanced solution to the problem.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the whole problem with immigration, is that it's so black and white, and yet more than any other issue, it probably demands nuance. I mean, there's a fellow who was out in California who wants to basically, you know, sort of challenge people and by saying, look, take my job. And he's, you know, a grape picker or a strawberry picker or an apple picker or a lettuce picker. He says, if you want my job, come here and take it. And they've been running this campaign in California, and so far three people have showed up. You know, again, it's part of the nuance to this is that everyone thinks that, you know, it's some guy taking your job away, and here they're running a campaign saying, take the job, and for whatever reason, nobody's coming.
Well, here in Iowa, a lot of us know the reason, because a lot of us detasseled corn as teenagers.
Right.
And we know
exactly how incredibly hard
it is.
Only one of my kids lasted 2 years. Everybody else bailed out after 2 weeks.
So I want to continue talking about immigration, and you can join the conversation as well as 866-780-9100. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPRTalk. But the White House, according to a very interesting article in the Washington Post yesterday, apparently White House strategists are saying that the long-term strategy in immigration is going to go toward the Democrats, because Republicans right now, with their hard line against immigration, are going to alienate millions of Latinos, which is the fastest growing minority group in the nation. Bruce, you want to respond to that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, our lesson on this issue, of course, was in campaign 2008, or actually in the year before, in 2007. That's when both parties, John McCain leading on one side, Obama and Clinton, and most of the Democrats on the other, but again, and not only McCain, actually, you certainly had as well Governor Romney as well weighing in on we need a long term solution to this problem, and therefore we're going to have to do something about the border and protecting the border and taking care of the border, but also we're going to have to do something about the 12 million or so illegal aliens already in the country, and we're going to have to find, we can't send everybody home, so we're going to have, it was a very reasonable and even at points nuanced discussion until we got the likes of Tom Tancredo and some of the on the strong right end of this issue, hammering away at illegal citizenship, and my people didn't go through all this, and on you went into a xenophobic kind of rant that suddenly flattened the whole issue into where. And everybody shut up and quit talking about immigration when we actually got into the 2008 campaign. It is such a hot issue that you've got to be able to find a way to open a dialogue one more time. And it was, unfortunately, something that did have bipartisan support that by now has lost it.
And I think there's something else going on here, whether it's John McCain or Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, is that there is a lot of frustration, and there is a lot of truth in some of the significant problems of dealing with undocumented workers, especially for states that are right along the Mexican border. There is no question. But what happens when people like Jan Brewer and John McCain put out misinformation and put out distortions and lie about this issue by creating these tales about what's happening in their own states. You know, I mean, if anyone doesn't know what's going on in Arizona, how can it not be the governor? And yet she puts out stories that turn out not to be true.
Right.
And that feeds everything we are talking about here. It feeds the people that want to cling to their urban legend. It feeds to the Hispanic community that is outraged because it isn't even based on the truth. It goes to the story of the woman from Georgia who's thrown under the bus based on this, you know, distorted piece of film from the NAACP in March. I mean, think about this. This is all, we are talking about very important public policy that will impact all of us, and so much of it never gets discussed because lies have destroyed the discussion.
Yeah, so no. Well, I mean that the whole information, the part of that on the Arizona, you must be talking about the Arizona crime statistics, where there actually has been
a reduction. And the headless
right.
bodies, the headless
and
bodies,
the headless
and the
oh yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, you can join our conversation today. The number is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, Arnie, which is that anybody with a computer can do anything pretty much right now. And it turns out that British Petroleum was doing a little bit of doctoring themselves. Apparently, BP doctored a photo that they put up on their website showing their disaster response headquarters, and they put in pictures of video feeds to make it look like they were really monitoring the oil spill when they weren't, and they didn't even doctor the photo particularly well, and a blogger pointed this out. But, it, you know, we've been trying to talk about clarity with BP and communication with BP. What does that say, that they're putting up false photos?
Well, you know, they claim that they had an overzealous person who was trying to show how good he was at Photoshop and look what he could do. He could look like they were more, you know, vigilant than they really were. But again, this story fits into a lot of people's perception of BP, because remember when their CEO was, you know, needed some time to get away and was playing polo or something in the middle of this crisis. I mean, the sad thing is that, again, if you're angry at BP, you don't trust them, you don't think they're being vigilant, you think that they're winking and nodding on you, and then you see this picture, it hurts everything. And this is the times we are living in. And to be honest with you, I don't know, Bruce or Charity, what do we do? What do we do when it's almost seamless the way it's happening? And it's happening at every level. And yet we are being asked to make decisions about, you know, environmental degradation, about drilling, about immigration, about unemployment. And we're swirling around with misinformation, and I don't even know where do you go to fact check. We're living in very, very scary times because of all this.
Yeah, I think, and the BP operation is, I think, a very good instance of the problem you're talking about, Arnie, because, of course, on the one hand, we know that their actual operations people were involved in you know, being some of their own inspectors to give reports to the government about their safety records so they could go forward. But also in this kind of instance, you have the PR people running the operations room, which puts you one more step beyond what's actually happening when you put a drill bit into the ground.
But the PR people are running politics everywhere.
It's
not just BP that the PR people are running. Look what we were just talking about. Is Barack Obama's approach to Arizona good for the next election cycle so they can attract Hispanic voters? No. I want to know if it's right for the country. I don't want to know whether it's going to attract a voter. I want to know about 2012. I want to know whether we are solving a problem, not because we're playing it by weighing who we're going to lose and who we're going to win by this, because in the end, this issue of immigration does touch all of us, and I want to have a way of figuring out how to resolve it so people are not running into the shadows in fear, so we can get the workers we need, so we're not going to have to put this misinformation out in Arizona and give cops in Arizona a responsibility they never really envisioned. I mean, think about this.
Right.
Just what they said about playing it out for the Hispanic vote really almost undermines whether it's a good decision or a bad decision, because it's a political one.
Because it makes you evaluate the decision in a different
yes.
way. Right.
Yes.
I agree.
Absolutely.
I agree.
We just have a moment before we go today, and I want to go a little inside baseball here, but I saw a report yesterday. Helen Thomas, of course, has left the press corps and has vacated the front row seat that she sat in for decades in the White House conference room, and a number of organizations have thrown their hats into the ring to get that seat. So far, Fox News, Bloomberg, and yesterday we found that NPR has put their hat in the ring as well. And I read the letter that NPR wrote, and this is kind of interesting because Fox and Bloomberg both sent letters saying why they should have that seat and why the other organization absolutely should not have that seat. NPR managed to write a letter where they didn't slam either of the other two organizations and just made their own case. But the White House correspondents, of course, pick who gets that seat. Arnie, where do you think it's going to go?
I think they should take all the applications, throw them down to the bottom of the stairs, and whoever lands, I mean, in some ways, it's almost the safest bet, because it will not be a fend. It'll be the luck of the draw, and that's how it happens. And probably it should not be static. It should be something where it is maybe a shared investment, because I'm not sure there's anyone that has risen to the level. I mean, just because you're being there doesn't mean that you can be trusted. And maybe we need a rotating chair or a rotating seat. And, of course, someone's going to say to me, well, then we should have a rotating caucus, Arnie, and a rotating primary. And then I'm going to have to say, oh, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that.
All right, Bruce, you want to weigh in 10 seconds?
No, I'm asking Vilsack to reconsider Helen Thomas for the seat.
All right. Thank you so much. Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst, and Bruce Gronbeck, a professor emeritus at the University of Iowa. Thank you both so much for being here today. And thank you for listening. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. We had production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. You can get in touch with us anytime at Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Charity Nebbe.